I'm Marty Moscoe-Wayne. Welcome to Ballot Talks on Radio Times, our regular Thursday show. President Obama told voters in November, "I hear you," after Republicans won big. He said that the message from the electorate was, "Get stuff done." And that's what he's been doing, much to the consternation of his critics, including those in the GOP. He quickly used his executive authority to change immigration policy to reduce the number of deportations, announced a climate agreement with China, and voiced his support for net neutrality. Yesterday, 17 states filed suit asking the courts to block Obama's actions on immigration, saying they trample the Constitution. What will happen next year when he faces a Republican-controlled Congress with Mitch McConnell as Senate Majority Leader? Here in this edition of Ballot Talks, we want to talk about President Obama, what remains of his couple of years in office. And we have two guests who have joined us, including James Oliphant, White House correspondent for the National Journal. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times, Jim.
It's great to be here, Marty.
Also with us is Ron Elving, and he directs coverage of D.C. and national politics as senior Washington editor for National Public Radio for NPR. And Ron Elving, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Good to be with you.
And to our listeners, lines always open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Ron, let me begin with you. Do you think President Obama is more alone or even isolated than he ever has been? He's going to be facing Republicans in Republican-controlled House and Senate, and so many Democrats wanted to keep their distance from him when they were running for either election or re-election.
That is right. Many Democrats did run against the president implicitly by not really supporting him and not wanting him in their state campaigning for them. In one famous case in Kentucky, the Democratic candidate didn't even want to say whether or not she had voted for Barack Obama, the Democratic nominee. This is a typical situation, unfortunately, in our system. The last five presidents who were elected to a second term had to deal with a Senate in the second term that was controlled in the last 2 years, at least, by the other party. Even some of the presidents who had the control of the Senate, such as Jimmy Carter, who wasn't reelected in 1980, but in his last 2 years in office, he had a Democratic Senate, and he was pretty much openly at war with them. One of them even ran against him for the nomination in 1980. So a hostile Senate is, regrettably, more or less the norm in the late years of a presidency, and some of our two-term presidents have actually managed to deal with that pretty successfully, oftentimes with the help of very good chiefs of staff like Howard Baker for Ronald Reagan in the 1980s. Reagan was pretty much on the ropes in 1987 and 1988 when it was the end of his presidency, and he was on his way out, and a lot of bad things had happened, and we had the Iran-Contra scandal, and he had lost badly in the 1986 election, lost control of the Senate, and yet his last 2 years in the presidency were quite successful. So there is still the opportunity for Barack Obama to make something of these last 2 years.
Do you think, Jim, that the president has the kind of political skills to take advantage or to use this opportunity as Ron was just describing?
Well, I think it depends, Marty, on what you define as political skills. I think it's interesting that we all saw that the president was not very contrite after the results on Election Day, and in fact frustrated many Republicans by sort of pressing ahead with immigration and net neutrality, as you noticed. And we are at sort of an interesting moment in American politics, because it seems like the White House has chosen to view the results as not necessarily something that is a limit on its own actions. So in terms of your question, I think the White House feels like it can go ahead aggressively on some individual issues within its own power. As for working with Congress, I still don't think that they necessarily have the toolkit for that, but we'll see. You know, the president gave a speech yesterday to a bunch of CEOs at the Business Roundtable and talked about common ground on corporate taxes and some other issues. And so we'll see. But right now, I think the White House is just as interested in seeing what it can do on its own as what it can do with Republicans.
And on its own, do you mean, Jim, the use of executive authority as he did with immigration?
That's right. And, you know, I don't think there's that many opportunities to do something on the order of the immigration executive order. But at the same time, certainly this White House does not see the Senate flipping as some sort of a rebuke of its own policies. And And I think that as we're going to what we're seeing right now in terms of just the fight right now over funding the government, these Republicans are going to tie themselves up in knots for a lot of the next 2 years. And the White House is not just going to sit on the sidelines and do nothing as a result of that.
Do you think, Ron, the president doesn't have to run for office again, that in a sort of weird way sort of frees him up to not have to worry about either his own reelection or maybe even the future of his own party?
I think there is some insight in that. The president is in some respects, in a more favorable position from the standpoint of what he wants to do than he has been in the first 6 years of his presidency. He had to worry about the Democratic majorities in the Congress when he had them. Then after he'd lost it in the House, he still had to worry about it in the Senate and had that curious creature to deal with, which is a split-control Congress, a House in hands of the Republicans in this case, Senate in the hands of the Democrats in this case. And those Congresses, generally speaking, have an extraordinarily difficult time getting out of their own way. And in this case, of course, we saw 4 years of highly dysfunctional Congress during that split control. So in some respects, having the Congress defined as his opponent, much as it worked for Bill Clinton after he lost both the House and Senate in 1994, sure, they impeached him, but he survived that, even in a Republican Senate, and went on to do some of the things, many of the things that he's best remembered for as he worked with Republicans.
Well, just picking up on that, and Ron, going back to you, and oftentimes the discussion is about the president's relationship with Republicans, but how would you see his relationship with his own party, with the Democrats in his own party?
It has not been good, as we've said, but now that they are all united more or less in the minority in Congress and their role has changed, they're not responsible for trying to move the Senate along anymore. And under those circumstances, they can draw clearer lines. They can work together because they are clearly on the same page. They are all ultimately in some degree of league with the Hillary Clinton campaign in 2016, assuming that she is going to run, and they have a common set of goals. So you're not going to see something like Democratic senators begging the president not to make his executive action with regard to immigration prior to the election and thereby depressing the Hispanic turnout in many states because they didn't want to lose votes in, say, Arkansas and Louisiana by making that move too soon. So those kinds of conflicts are going to go away, and the Democrats, while they won't be in control, may be more in control of their own destiny in the minority than they were in the majority.
And Jim, going back to immigration and even what Congress can do, and certainly the members of the Republican Party in Congress that want to stop this action by the president, what can they, if they have the power of the purse strings, can they use that to prevent what Obama did with his executive authority?
I think the general consensus on that is no, although there are certainly some Republicans believe that they can. A lot of the money that goes into the Homeland Security Department for immigration is as a result of user fees and things like that, and so do not come directly out of the Treasury. And I think what we're going to see is we're going to see some symbolic protests and some votes and maybe some attempts legislatively to write some language that may nullify the order. But I think it's anyone's guess as to whether that would actually work, because as we all know, the president has a great deal of discretion in terms of applying his executive authority here. But more interestingly, I think next year we're going to see if Republicans can pass any kind of an immigration bill. And I think what you're going to see is an increased focus on showing that they can do something in that area. And it's not going to be anything I think that advocates or Democrats want, but it may be a way for Republicans to show voters that, hey, we did something, and hope that some voters may be in the middle, give them some credit for that, or may not appreciate the nuances. So to them, I think it'll switch from protest to trying to produce something pretty quickly.
Well, in fact, when the president made his move, he said to Congress, or I guess to the House, pass a bill, because the Senate did pass a bill about a year and a half ago. Jim?
Yeah, and I think the House will want to try to pass a bill. And again, you know, remember that even if they do something, and even if the Senate were to pass something new, Mitch McConnell has talked about breaking up the bill that they passed last year and voting on it in individual pieces. The president's going to veto anything he doesn't like, and he's going to probably veto anything that attempts to undo what he did administratively unless it's covered in the bill. So again, we may just see a lot of sort of symbolic or representation votes and not have anything that actually comes out of Congress that's going to be signed into law.
And Ron, another wrinkle. Yesterday, 17 states filed suit asking the courts to block Obama's actions on immigration. They say it tramples the Constitution. Do you think this will go anywhere, or is this sort of part of the calculation?
It will make its way through the courts. And I can probably name the 17 states without looking at the list. I would guess they're also the same states that didn't want to expand Medicare under the Affordable Care Act and that have been generally in resistance, let us say, to that law. And that is going to make its way through the courts as the challenges to the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare have made their way through the courts, and some of which are still pending before the Supreme Court and could change the shape of that law quite drastically. So that is an important front in a multi-front struggle between not just Republicans and Democrats and not just the federal government and the state governments, but a general clash of attitudes towards what the role of government ought to be going forward and whether or not the federal government should be continuing in this role and whether or not we should be, in a sense, pulling all of these relationships between different parts of the country further into the changes that have been happening in the 21st century, or whether we should be going back to try to find a happier time, perhaps imaginary, but nonetheless a happier time in a lot of people's minds that would be idealized somewhere in the past.
And is one of those happier times back in the 1980s when the president and Congress were able to pass a pretty comprehensive immigration reform bill, Ron?
You know, that law passed in 1986, which was openly amnesty, which said that people who had been in the country for a certain period of time without getting into trouble were going to be okay and could have a path to not only legal status but eventual citizenship. That bill was thought to be by a lot of Republicans at that time to be the best solution to the problem, and there was a lot of Republican support for that bill. The supporter, the sponsor in the Senate, was Alan Simpson from Wyoming, who very famous conservative Republican from that part of the world, and it was actually a little harder to bring along a lot of the Democrats in the House who were afraid it was going to depress wages for union workers and so on. So the politics in 1986 were quite different. And that bill did result in a lot of people becoming legal. And it also saw the tide of people crossing the border from Mexico, from many countries, but crossing the border down at that southwestern extreme of the country. That number increased afterwards, and supposedly that wasn't going to happen. And as a result, the politics of immigration in the country gradually turned against that sort of liberalization. And now the Republican Party is quite uniformly, in at least in the House and largely in the majority in the Senate, quite against the particular handling of that issue that we saw in 1986. And amnesty has literally become a dirty word.
I want to pick up on that after this very short break. This is Ballot Talks on Radio Times, something we do every Thursday at this time on Radio Times. And that very familiar voice, Ron Elving, he's senior Washington editor for NPR. Also with us, James Oliphant, White House correspondent for the National Journal. And again, to join our conversation, we are talking about President Obama. And we want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times. Actually, this is Ballot Talks on Radio Times. And we're talking about President Obama. He's got two more years in office. He will be facing Republican majorities in both the House and Senate come 2015. And again, our guests are Ron Elving and James Oliphant. And you can also join us by sending us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and sending us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. We want to know what you think about what the president has been doing or has not been doing. Ron, I just want to pick up on something you said. You were talking about Ronald Reagan and the 1986 bill on immigration about amnesty. But what's so interesting about what President Obama did is it really wasn't about amnesty. It was that he just wasn't going to deport people. And he's pretty much been known by some of his critics as the deporter in chief.
That is because many people have been deported during the Obama presidency, greater numbers, really, than during the last Bush presidency. And that was a tremendous disappointment to people who had voted for him in 2008 and 2012, thinking that he would be more generous toward immigrants who were in the country illegally. And, of course, he did put in place the Deferred Action Program for the children of people who had come into the country illegally, bringing these minor children with them. Obviously, the minor children had nothing to say about it. And many of them had gone on to pretty distinguished academic and careers, served in the military. And the president was saying that people like that should not be deported. But it was only deferred action. It wasn't amnesty. And the action that he has taken in recent weeks is also deferred deportation. It is not citizenship. It is not amnesty from any legal vulnerability in the future. And a future president, a future Congress could change what the president has done. They could do it rather easily. They could do it as swiftly as the president changed the rules in making this deferred action announcement.
Let me go back to you, Jim. And actually, I'm looking at a headline of one of your stories. It says, "Face it, Obama is a lousy politician." Describe what you wrote in that piece.
Well, it's certainly provocative, right?
It sure is.
Well, that was on the heels of Election Day, and a lot of it has, I think, was a critique of the president's own personal style, and it goes back to what you were talking about earlier in the program, Marty. This idea of he just doesn't do a lot of the little stuff well in terms of reaching out to people on the Hill, and also in terms of the way that he addresses the American public. And I think we saw this maybe most recently with the riots in Ferguson, which he is just the kind of person who he's an equivocator. I mean, he's someone who points out both sides of the issue. He does not stir hearts and minds like he did back in 2008. He's kind of an explainer. And there was a feeling all through the campaign this year that he just never really outlined a specific agenda, maybe an economic agenda or something that the Democratic Party could run on. And that sort of lack of vision, that lack of the big picture, is something that bothers a lot of advocates a lot on the Democratic side. And so one of the more interesting things, I think, going forward is whether he feels, as you noted, more liberated mm-hmm. by the fact that he doesn't have to run again. And will he sort of step up his game on a thematic level? Will he try to address bigger themes? I think what we're seeing right now in terms of the unrest over Ferguson and then the Eric Garner decision yesterday is there may be a moment here where the president may try to get a little deeper into the frustration in African-American communities and try to address it on the kind of level that he did back in May of 2008. And on the kind of level he's largely avoided during his presidency. So it'll be interesting to see if he finds his voice in a little bit more of a dramatic fashion than he has to date.
Ron, do you think he's a lousy politician, as this headline says?
I think there are different kinds of politics and different kinds of politicians, and certainly, I think it was probably Mario Cuomo who said that campaigning was poetry and governing was prose. Mm-hmm. There are politicians who are much better at one than the other. Obviously, Barack Obama was magnificent as a candidate in 2007, 2008. He was pretty good as a candidate in 2012 in drawing the right kinds of contrast with Mitt Romney and some of the Republicans in Congress. But as a governing politician, I would have to agree with Jim. He has been a great disappointment, both to his supporters and to people who were sort of voting for him in 2008, thinking, gee, I don't know who this guy is really yet, but I think maybe he might be pretty good. In the reality, he has indulged himself in many ways that I think disturbed people. The kinds of shots that he takes at his opponents that are sort of gratuitous, the kinds of ways that he does not really dig in and do the dirty work, if you will, of calling people and begging people and doing things for people and bringing people along who might be susceptible on certain things. We saw this with the Affordable Care Act. We've seen it again with immigration. The president wants to prevail, and he wants other people to do some of that dirty work, and he isn't particularly given to it himself. It isn't something that he really responds to. It's probably not something that most people enjoy, and not everyone's going to be an LBJ. But the other thing I think he's been a little bit tone deaf on is some of the symbology in these last couple of years in terms of his recreation. Certainly anyone should go wherever they want for vacation, but, you know, enough Martha's Vineyard for some people by the president. And you know, the Gulf, I think, is also created a certain distance between the president and some of his natural constituency.
Let me go back to you, Jim. And Ron mentioned LBJ. And, you know, there are all those famous pictures of him kind of staring down or leaning over people to get them to do his will. But one of the arguments that I've heard is that presidents don't have the kind of earmarks or, you know, the goodies that they can use when they're wheeling and dealing and over an issue. Do you think that has limited what this president has been able to do?
Well, I think that's part of it, but I don't think that's a huge part of it, because I don't think that's the kind of thing that Barack Obama would use in a way that maybe an LBJ or somebody else would. I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that he is somebody who just, as Ron noted, he's just really uncomfortable with the sort of idea, the idea of deal cutting and surrendering his position. He's more of a guy who's always believed that if he sat in a room and explained things clearly, the other side would just sort of capitulate out of deference. I might add, too, that one of the things that's going to limit him now is you have this very loud progressive activist wing of the Democratic Party, encapsulated in Elizabeth Warren. And they're not really going to want Obama to cut a lot of deals. I mean, you know, there have been a lot of pragmatic moderates who've been saying, give in on Keystone, for God's sake, and, you know, get something for it. That's how you do it. You know, it's not something you particularly care about that much, and you can get things in return for it. But, you know, you have a lot of activity on the left that says, no, we're not going to let you compromise. And, you know, the Republicans are always blamed for being very intransigent, excuse me. But there's that same unwillingness on the Democratic side to cut deals. I mean, we saw this with the tax package that was coming out of Congress over the last couple of weeks. And that's just a reflection of our polarized politics. So it's not just a matter of just having incentives. It's just literally harder to find that middle space where there are enough bodies in the room to actually agree on something.
But do you think, Ron, I mean, if the and this is obviously the advantage of hindsight, but if he had wined and dined people, Republicans at the White House, and had them over to watch football and movies, we would be having a different conversation?
Not really. I don't think that that's ultimately what makes it happen. I think what makes it happen is an extended negotiation, sometimes facilitated or lubricated by some of those kinds of social engagements that you described, which I don't think are a bad thing. I think that that's probably the way you get a lot of these negotiations done. But it's the give and take of the negotiations of, yeah, I'll give you this, but I got to get something for it. Yeah, I got to have this, but I'll give you something for it. Ultimately, that's the kind of politics that makes it possible for someone to govern. That's the pros that Mario Cuomo was talking about.
And when we hear that Republicans, after he was elected, say, you know, we're going to do everything in our power to make sure he doesn't get a second term, is that sort of business as usual, Ron, in Washington, or was there something more nefarious about that?
I don't know if it was nefarious, but it certainly was bald. And there was not what I recall in past administrations of at least a show of respect for the office and respect for whoever had won it. And I don't think that there was quite the same sense of acceptance that this was the new American symbol, that this man now embodied the nation, that we saw, for example, in deference to Ronald Reagan in his first term, from a lot of Democrats who went along with his program. And perhaps some of that was denied George W. Bush in the early months of 2001 after that disputed election that installed him in the White House. A lot of Democrats refused to see him as fully president until 9/11 came along, and that unified the nation. And nothing like that happened for Barack Obama. So the resistance of the Republicans did seem to have a little different cast to it, and statements like Mitch McConnell saying, you know, our agenda is to stop him from having a second term, that it seemed to me was unusually bald, if not necessarily a departure from past strategy.
This is Ballot Talks on Radio Times, and that's Ron Elving, senior Washington editor for NPR. Also with us, James Oliphant, White House correspondent for the National Journal. We are talking about President Obama in this hour, past, present, and future. And again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Emails, radio Radio Times at WHYY.org. And you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. And you can also post something on our Facebook page as well. We have an email from Doug, and he says, I'll put this to you, Jim. Republicans have had only one policy, obstruct Obama, and yet Obama gets blamed for, quote, not reaching out to the Republicans. Strange world. Is that a strange world, or is this just how the world is within Washington, D.C.?
Well, for one thing, when you're president of the United States, you have the biggest pulpit. You take the biggest hits. The president himself has said that. From the Republican point of view, they can say, well, look, it worked. They have both chambers of Congress. They've got a lot of grief for the shutdown. But, at the same time, they were able to turn the Senate. Obviously, a lot of that is a result of the map and demographics and things like that. But it's a fair criticism to say that, the Republicans could do more. The problem with our current political situation is there's not a great deal incentive on almost either side to do a lot of deal making, because it's the way the House districts are drawn, it's where the battlegrounds are, and that you have these two coalitions. You have the Obama coalition, which is unmarried women and Hispanics and African Americans and young people, and then you have sort of this establishment class with the Republicans of older, whiter males. And so each group is sort of, there's not a lot of commonality between the two of them. And it sort of goes back to the point I was making before, where you don't have this shared universe of mutual interests. And, and that's where deal making comes from. That's where compromise comes from. So in that sense, neither side has a great incentive to cut a deal.
Let me get William from, looks like Collingdale, to join us on Radio Times. Hi, William. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Allow me to frame my question here.
Sure.
In the Bible, Jesus Christ says that if you want to be the greatest leader, you would first be the greatest servant and a servant to all. And, during his first election, I voted for the president because he had a path of public service in his local community that continued to grow until he served in, I think it was the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what framed my decision about, whether I was going to vote for him or the other candidate. And I always look at public office as, you're there first to serve. And if your capacity to serve continues to grow, then, go for the next office so that your capacity is not limited.
Yeah, William, let me just jump in here, only because we've got a lot of people that want to join us. If I can get you to focus in on the president and what you think today.
Yeah. Well, let's look at the opposition. I think that it's harrowing that it's publicly accepted that politicians can oppose any policy that would elevate the quality of life for the greater number of people.
Hmm.
Well, and it seems like, because of the midterm election, that everybody's saying, we're in power. But he was always championing the policies that would elevate the quality of life for the greater number of Americans.
Well, let me take your point, and actually let me toss it to you, Ron Elving. And this is obviously going back on the election. And, obviously William is a supporter of the president, seeing that he represents all people. There is this whole question about, when you're elected, who are you serving, and sort of looking at his policies as a whole. And his call also reminded me that while some parts of the economy have done better, we've seen this growing divide between the rich and the poor under President Obama. I don't know. Any comments to William's comment?
There's always a dispute as to what the greatest good for the greatest number may actually mean. We have a democracy, but unfortunately, the majority of people who are eligible to vote don't do so. The people who are registered to vote in the most recent election, only 36% of those people came out to vote. That is a rather minor fraction when you consider that these are people who had the option of actually doing it. And then there are a certain number of people who don't even register and a certain number of people who aren't allowed to vote. So the greatest number are not necessarily actually empowered, even in this country that has been working at being a democracy for over 200 years. So it's a little bit difficult to find the expression of the most popular will in our country. Polls tend to show it being somewhat different from election outcomes. And polling in and of itself is really just an attempt and a very human attempt to figure out what people really want. So it's difficult to know the answer to the basic question. It is not assumable that everyone would agree that any given policy is the greatest good for the greatest number of people, even if something is really trying very hard to be exactly that.
Let me read a tweet from Adam. I'll give this to you, Jim. On Obama, we can talk about his deep conservatism. He talks about torture. He talks about drone continuity with Bush, question mark. Do you see it that way?
Well, I think that there's certainly room for criticism on the left about Obama's national security policies and the sense of continuity with the Bush administration. And I think most presidents are more conservative when it comes to national security than their domestic policies. So in that respect, I think there, you know, Obama has, you know, he's liked to talk to himself as a war ender and not a war starter. But certainly, you know, we're not leaving Iraq or Syria anytime soon, at least in terms of our military presence there. And then, you know, we're going to have a very interesting moment next week when this long-delayed report comes out on abuses by the Central Intelligence Agency during the Bush administration. And there's been a very public battle between the White House and the Democratic Senate over what's going to be classified in that report and what's going to be released to the public. And we're going to see very plainly whether the White House is willing at all to be transparent about this stuff, or whether they are going to sort of adopt the same mantle of secrecy that the Bush administration took. And, I mean, and then that has been their modus operandi so far. So it's going to be an interesting moment.
And Ron, we're almost having a break here. This is a report that's been around, or I guess it's been sort of kicked around for a couple of years now.
Yes, and it is going to be deeply embarrassing to the United States and also to the governments of a number of other countries that are believed to have assisted the United States in some of these torture policies during the previous decade. Now, this is, of course, activity that took place some years ago. But when it comes out now, it will be laid at the doorstep of the United States of this moment. And that United States is 6-7 years into the presidency of Barack Obama. So even though he would have been among those who are the most vociferous critics of this program back during the Bush administration as a senator, now he's the president of the United States. He's the head of the national security operation and the intelligence gathering operation. And so the exposure of these practices under his watch will be laid at his feet as well.
Well, let's take that break and then we'll get back to our conversation. We are talking about President Obama on this Ballot Talks edition of Radio Times. That's Ron Elving, senior Washington editor for NPR. Also with us, James Oliphant, White House correspondent for the National Journal. And we've got calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. We'll be right back. It's Ballot Talks on Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscowane. This is our weekly look at all things election-related. And today we're examining the Obama presidency after his party got beaten up in November, putting Republicans in control of both the House and the Senate. Obama, though, has been busy in the last month. He negotiated a climate deal with China. He also used his executive authority to change immigration policy. He's looking to fill some several cabinet positions. Some Republicans are looking to dismantle his signature legislation, the Affordable Care Act. And again, our guests are Ron Elving and Jim Oliphant. And calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Jim, let me go back to you. One of you mentioned the Keystone XL pipeline, and this has been, you know, I guess on the drawing board for a couple of years now. The president did have some pretty critical statements about it and about Canada, in a sense, sort of using the United States to ship its oil overseas. Do you see that there's more and more pressure on the president himself, the State Department, the White House, to make a decision on Keystone XL pipeline?
Well, they're going to have to do it at some point. I mean, this can't go on forever, even though it already feels like it has. But yeah, you know, one of the things the White House is, they have not wanted to be hurried into it by Congress, and so they've wanted to be as deliberate as possible. And it may be because they're trying to lay you know, the proper groundwork for whatever decision emerges. But you know, it's going to be a situation where the president is getting a lot of pressure on the environmental left, and there are conflicting studies as to whether, you know, the pipeline would do any good at all in terms of you know, oil prices or America's own energy position, because, as you noted, most of this oil goes overseas into the global economy and has no effect on domestic oil production. So, you know, I think the bigger point does go back to whether he would use this as an opportunity to horse trade, and so far he's shown almost no inclination to do it.
Yeah. Anything you want to add to that, Ron?
Just that this is really a relic. This pipeline is something that probably would not even be initiated today, given the price of oil, given the glut almost of oil on the world market, which will not go on forever, of course, but which has really changed the economics for the moment. It's really an artifact of our relations with Canada. Canada is very high on getting this oil to market, and this is the best way for them to do it. And it's also a political football that so many people have talked about for so long that they have to insist it really matters.
And you're saying it doesn't, Ron?
I'm saying it really doesn't matter much to the world oil market. It does matter to Canada, and it does matter to people who have talked about it to the point where they have to prove that it's really significant.
We've been talking about the president and his relationships, such as they are with Congress. To you, Ron, how do you see his relationship, or such as it is with Mitch McConnell, or do you see them being able to work together?
You know, I remember one of these dinners a few years back when the president was poking fun at people who had been his critics, and he said, people are always telling me I should go have a beer with Mitch McConnell. And I say to them, you have a beer with Mitch McConnell. And there really isn't a personal relationship here. It just doesn't exist. And usually presidents, particularly those who have had some time on Capitol Hill, and it was very brief, but President Obama was for 4 years a senator. He would actually paid a visit to the Senate during the first two of those years and then was pretty much running for president the latter 2 years. He did not build up a lot of good relationships with other senators, particularly not on the Republican side. There were a few. Chuck Hagel was one. And the president really doesn't have a good background with respect to some of these people, and that's why he's used Joe Biden to do a lot of his negotiating with Mitch McConnell, and that worked for at least a little while.
Yeah.
And the president really doesn't have much to draw on here, and it's very hard to start that up now.
Jim, do you think Kentucky bourbon would help?
Well, in my experience, it's never hurt, but I will say that McConnell is going to like being majority leader. And he has to worry a little bit about keeping that job because the map in 2016 is not as favorable to Republicans as it was this year. States like Illinois and other sort of bluish states are going to be up. And so he may feel some pressure to get some stuff done. And that's always, you know, there was a lot of talk around the time of the immigration order that the president was, quote, poisoning the well. In terms of working with Republicans in the future. But the truth is that the GOP, they're going to act out of their own self-interest regardless, and whether that's on trade or immigration or infrastructure, things like that, they may want to have some stuff to talk about when these senators are out stumping in 2016. They want to have a record to point to. So if Mitch McConnell finds any common ground with President Obama, it's going to be because of that.
Mm. Let me get to Rama from, looks like, Oaks, Pennsylvania to join us. Rama, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi there. I'm an Indian immigrant who would be eligible to vote in 2016. And I come from the world's largest democracy, and I've never, ever seen such kind of obstructionism ever for Mr. President Obama. And it gets me thinking that would I ever vote for a Republican in my lifetime, which is basically no. Would my son, who is a United States citizen, would he ever vote Republican? No, he would not.
Hmm.
So I do not know what the GOP is trying to achieve when they're probably isolating most of the immigrant community where you would see the most population growth in the future.
Well, that's an interesting point, Ron, and I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Ron, can I toss that first to you?
Well, the caller is absolutely right that the immigrant community is going to grow as a voting force in the years ahead, as it did roughly a century ago when we got huge waves of immigrants into this country, including my grandfather, and they eventually joined the voting public and became a majority in many, many states. And largely, they became Democrats. They became Democrats, particularly in those states where there had been resistance to their political participation. And that lasted for a generation or two, and it was an enormous factor in the huge Democratic majorities of the 30s and in certain elections thereafter. That could happen again, Or, in the politics of our time, the Republican Party may come to symbolize something different to immigrants, recent immigrants, in the next 10 or 20 years. It's probably going to take a few years, but it's probably going to happen over a longer stretch of time that the Republicans will come to symbolize something different, opportunity. It may be economics, but the Republican Party probably will not be in this particular kind of push-them-back-out mode indefinitely.
You know, Jim, I'm looking at the various screens that are staring at me, and just about all the comments are about how obstructionist the Republican Party is and that Obama's being unfairly criticized for not getting things done. I'm also looking at a piece that Paul Krugman did in the Rolling Stone, I guess a month or two ago, listing all the accomplishments of the president. I mean, how do you work your way through these really competing points of view?
Well, and I think there's something to all of it. And going back to actually what the caller said is that, you know, you have to remember that a lot of our modern politics is a product of demographics. And, you know, it was interesting that he said he would not vote for Republican and his son would not vote for Republican. And there are plenty of Republicans who feel the same way about Democrats. And as long as that exists, we're going to have this polarized culture. And, you know, the next election may, you know, if the Republicans were to say run a Marco Rubio, maybe we would see some swing in the Hispanic vote, and that might break the stranglehold and sort of the impasse that we have demographically. So the larger question is, you know, is Obama the president of the United States, or is he the president of his coalition? And, you know, and the idea is, are you a success if there are chunks of the country that just don't believe in you and that you can't speak to? And if you say that he may be lost, you know, if he was elected with a, you know, a 50-plus majority vote two times, but, you know, there are significant chunks of that vote that have now gone the other way or now disapprove of him, can you say his presidency was a success? Mm. And, you know, he's lost two houses of Congress. He's you know, in the 40% range. So it's a difficult question because, if you ask someone whether health care is an accomplishment, you'll get a different answer from a lot of different people, you know. And if you can say, could the economy be better right now than it is? Yeah, I mean, maybe it could or maybe it couldn't. So the question of his accomplishments as president, I think, goes back to the question of polarization. In other words, if you're a fan of the president, you're going to see him as having a very distinguished and productive record. But if you're a critic, there's lots of ground to be critical.
Does that mean we have to wait for historians to decide whether he was a good president or not?
Well, you know, what's really interesting about that is that the White House has had a mentality for years that ultimately is going to be the president's vindication, which I think is fitting for someone who has sometimes been presented as academically inclined. But no, I mean, there is this idea that he will be vindicated by history, that the public will eventually understand the great hole the country was in 07, 08, 09. And that the president will get credit for lifting the country out of that hole. And eventually that the middle class will feel some more of the recovery than it's feeling right now. Unfortunately for the White House and the president at the moment, that's just not what's happening.
Ron, let me put something else here. And Chuck Hagel's name came up, and obviously we know that he is going to be stepping down as defense secretary. There are a couple of names have been bandied about. Also, Eric Holder, his replacement from the president's point of view, Loretta Lynch. Do you think he'll have problems getting Lynch or whoever will be the defense secretary to get them through Congress?
I expect that there will be problems with Loretta Lynch, although she has been a non-controversial figure in the past, has been approved by the Senate without objection. She will now become a symbol of Barack Obama. Anyone that he nominates will become a symbol of Barack Obama. And she is also caught up in this case in New York with the chokehold death of Eric Garner. She is going to have to be involved in whether or not the Department of Justice makes a further attempt to seek justice in that particular case. So that is going to make her a flashpoint for some of the most fraught and difficult issues in America today in the next weeks. And, of course, she was already going to have a more difficult time because of her association with the president. As to the Defense Department, it would appear that the White House is going to choose someone who is not going to generate a great deal of controversy on his own, and someone that the Congress would be able to quickly approve, or that is to say the Senate would quickly approve, and that would probably not be the focal point for another battle with the president. We'll see. They can always find a way if they want to have a fight.
Are you talking about Ashton Carter or just sort of a generic, more generic person than that?
Ashton Carter is, at the moment, the only person on the short list. It's not official, but right. but this is the person that we're essentially vetting at this moment. And everyone else has either stepped back or, for one reason or another, been eliminated from the list. And in this particular case, he would seem, having been deputy in the past and having the kind of intellectual background that he has as a physicist, he would be the sort of person who would be non-controversial for the Senate.
Jim, one of the criticisms, maybe coming from Hagel himself or from his people, is that his complaint was that the White House just tried to control too much of what was his job. Do you think that's true? Do you think that's a problem? Do you think that's the way this White House operates, that everything kind of comes from them?
Well, it is very much the way this White House operates, and that is, you know, it's a big believer in centralization and planning at the top, and Hagel wasn't the first Secretary of Defense to complain about that. Bob Gates and Leon Panetta both complained about it, and you know, cynically, you could view the nomination of Ashton Carter as the White House wanting a sort of a technocrat or a bureaucrat in that role, and someone who's not going to be concerned with their own political position, and in that way, make him a little easier maybe to work around. And I don't think that's going to change. I think the White House fundamentally believes it should be running, policy from the West Wing and not necessarily deferring to the agencies or even the Pentagon.
So, Ron, has the next presidential election, has it begun?
Absolutely. I would say it began well before the midterm election, and people have been positioning themselves in the Republican Party, which has well over a dozen prospects for its nomination and no clear front runner, no one who has more than 12% or 13% in the polls in the states that will make the decision, the first nominating states, the first primary and caucus states. And so there, that competition has been going on for years and certainly intensified in recent months. On the Democratic side, we have a curious case where there is no incumbent. There is no incumbent vice president who is the front runner, although the incumbent vice president would certainly be willing to be president and may still run, I suppose. We have instead a presumptive candidate who has not been president or vice president, and Hillary Clinton. So that certainly is a story, a saga, a history that has been going on for quite some time.
Indeed. Anything you want to add to that, Jim?
Well, right. Yeah, we're already it's interesting in Washington. A lot of the reporters who are covering the White House have been shifted to the quote Clinton campaign, even though there isn't an official campaign. So the watch is very much on. I will say on the Republican side, getting back to immigration, that it's interesting if you view the executive order as sort of a trap for Republicans, because they certainly do want to get some share of the Hispanic vote in 2016. And what it's done and what's going to continue to do is force a lot of these possible primary candidates like Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio and Rand Paul and maybe Chris Christie to sort of state their get on the record right now about these ideas of a path to citizenship. And that may be something that comes around to haunt them in a general election a couple of years from now.
But can this is sort of asking you to get in the mind of Hillary Clinton. I mean, after all the sort of will she, won't she, can you imagine her saying, nah, I don't think I want to run for president after all, Jim?
I think that's highly unlikely. It just, she just is conducting herself as somebody who's gearing up for this. And there's just such a sense of, and this is the same thing we saw in 2007 and 2008, unfortunately for her, but this sense of an inevitability and that it's her time. And then the Democratic field beyond her is just, there's just not a lot of potential candidates there. I mean, people like Joe Biden or Elizabeth Warren or Martin O'Malley would rush in to fill that void.
Yeah.
But she's not acting like somebody who's just sort of doing this on a lark. Every indication is that there's a sort of a massive underground operation that is getting ready to go.
Any final word from you, Ron, before we have to say goodbye?
Just that that operation has been operating for a number of years now, and that when they built the Clinton Library down in Little Rock, Arkansas, they built another one right alongside of it as a conference center that could double as a second presidential library.
I did not know that. Ron Elving, thanks for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
Senior Washington editor for NPR. Jim Oliphant, thank you for joining us as well.
My pleasure, Marty.
And he's White House correspondent for National Journal, joining us on Ballot Talks on Radio Times, something we do every Thursday at this time. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program and to tell us what you think about it. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thanks for joining us. Do stay with us for Hour 2. We'll be right back.
Zaxby's just out Philly the Philly again. The Zaxby's Chicken Philly is back with garlic aioli, sautéed peppers and onions, decadent melty cheese, and your choice of Zaxby's signature crispy chicken fingers or delicious grilled chicken. But it's only back for a limited time, so enjoy it while you can. No pressure. It's just the greatest sandwich of all time on a ticking clock. Order the Chicken Philly today. Who's got the sauce? Zaxby's.